The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you very much for the kind words, and thank you all for being here. This is a book that I have had in mind to write for a long time. We all know that America is a land of equality, of freedom for all. And we know that it was founded that way. And yet the story that we still have, that we still tell of the founding, is one of the men in powdered wigs, of the elites, right? So I had in mind to tell, I write narrative history, and to me that means people in their times in conflict, because people tend to be in conflict. And I wanted to write a story, a nonfiction story, pick a range of people from different backgrounds. What did it feel like to be living at that moment, to be fighting for this thing called freedom, if you were a slave, if you were one of those people in the powdered wigs, a woman, a loyalist? What about the Native Americans? So that was my thought, and it turned out to be a much harder task than I had expected, because for one thing, most of the ordinary people, their lives aren't terribly well documented, and I write nonfiction, so I needed letters, I needed memoirs, things like that. I also, of course, wanted people from a range of backgrounds, and I wanted people whose paths crossed, because I really wanted to create one story, not five or six different chapters side by side. So I spent about 2 years kind of auditioning people for roles in it, and slowly, one by one, these pieces fell into place. And what I'm going to do is walk you quickly through these six people whose stories I settled on. Somewhere near the end of this, I was conscious of the fact that what I was doing was I had six people's lives who were all being mediated through one consciousness, mine, the writer's. And I got curious. I wanted to see visually what these six people would look like mediated through one consciousness. And I wanted to see them all portrayed. It happens that my sister is an artist, and she obliged me. She created portraits of each of them. Four of the six are based on portraits from life. The other two, we don't have images of them from life, so those are composite images. So I am going to show you those for fun. And with each one, I will then tell you a little bit about that person's story. This is the first one. I wanted the British perspective on the war. His name is, at birth, was George Sackville. Later, he became Lord George Germain. And to give you an idea of his upbringing, he was raised in a house in the southeast of England called Knoll, K-N-O-L-E. And it was built according to what was then a fad among the elite, among the very wealthy. It was called a calendar house. So there were 12 separate entrances, one for each month of the year, 7 interior courtyards, one for each day of the week, 52 interior staircases, one for each week of the year, and 365 rooms. He was a teenager before he could go through the whole house without getting lost. So this is how he grows up in extreme wealth. His father was a diplomat. He went with him to Ireland, and in doing so, as a young man, he got his first lesson in the administering of an empire. He then decided that from very early on, he was a combative, aggressive personality, and so he joined the army as an officer, because he wanted to, that was a way to get honor, and he had a lot of ambition. And he won all kinds of accolades in battle. He rapidly progressed. People began talking about him as a future prime minister. He was very well known. And then it all came crashing down in 1759 when he failed to carry out an order to charge in a battle in a place called Minden in Germany against the French. This is the 7 Years' War in this country. It was the French and Indian War. And this battle was so significant that if the English were able to really crush the French in this battle, it was thought that that would end the war. The French would have to surrender. And it was thought that this charge, this cavalry charge of his, would have done that. But he failed to charge when he was asked to. His name became mud. He was the most hated man in England. He was court-martialed. He wanted the court-martial because he was a very aggressive type, and he wanted to clear his name. It had the opposite effect. He was almost executed for treason. He lost all of his titles, all of his honors. He went tumbling all the way down to the ground. That was 1759. Slowly, inexorably, he begins clawing his way back up rungs of power. And then in 1772, they said, okay, we'll give him the title, the position of Undersecretary of State for the American colonies. So just as the colonies are about to declare war, he's put in charge of them. So he ends up running the war. And both his enemies and his friends in the government knew that he was running the war in part out of a need to redeem himself. And his enemies, the Whigs in Parliament, would, when they wanted to really get him, they would call him the Coward of Minden. So the whole time, you know, the Americans are fighting this war and the Redcoats are doing the things they're doing, behind the scenes is this man orchestrating it, and orchestrating it really out of this very personal motivation in part. So that's what attracted me to him. This is the next of my six people. His name was Venture Smith. This is a composite image. We don't know what he looked like. My sister, the artist, based this on, he was probably a member of the Fulani tribe in West Africa, and she based this on an 18th century Fulani mask, and she used as clothing typical New England, because he lived his life in New England, New England farm clothing. So he's born in West Africa. He's the son of a prince. His village is attacked when he's 10 years old. He watches his father die. He's taken prisoner. That army is attacked by another army, and that army then takes him prisoner at the coast at a place in what's now Ghana called Anomabo. And there at Anomabo was one of these European slaving forts. And it happened that the ship that was in harbor was from Newport, Rhode Island. It was called the Charming Susanna. And so he was sold as a slave onto this ship. He lucked out in one respect. Most of the slaves, there were 87 of them, were bound for Barbados, where life was really brutal and you died very early. But the ship's steward liked him. He was young, he was strong, he was smart. So the steward, a man named Robinson Mumford, bought him for his own property. His name at birth was Brotir Furo, but the steward changed his name. At the time, these officers would go to sea with goods that they would personally trade, and the goods that you brought with you were called your venture. So his venture happened to be 4 pieces of calico cloth and a gallon of rum, and so that's what he gave for the boy, and therefore he called the boy Venture. So Venture then lives out his life with several different masters in Fisher's Island and Long Island Sound, and then in coastal Connecticut. And he grows to be a very strong man. He's famous for the feats of strength, and very wily. And he gets to the point where he, with the last transfer of owners, he decides he wants to pick the right owner for him. He wants to pick someone who will guarantee him that he will let him buy his freedom. And he actually interviews different owners. He had achieved a certain stature. And he interviews different people And he settles on a man named Oliver Smith, who was a well-known merchant in Stonington, Connecticut. And Smith says that, yes, I'll allow you eventually to allow you to work nights and work pre-dawn, and you can save that money and buy your freedom and your families. By this time, he has a wife and children. So that's what he does. He eventually he buys himself, and then he buys his two sons out of slavery, then he buys his wife and daughter. And everything about him is calculated and cagey, and especially with money. It's all, he has a very transactional sensibility. So that he buys himself out first, and then his sons, because he reckons that they can earn money faster, and they can therefore buy the wife and daughter out of slavery more quickly. So his life then plays out in rural Connecticut. He goes, what really fascinated me about him is what I was just talking about is transpiring while white Americans are, you know, the Stamp Act, the Townsend duties, these milestones when Britain was imposing stiffer regulations on the Americans or taxes, and the Americans are getting angrier and angrier and talking about freedom. And many of them felt that freedom meant for everyone. If they got freedom, it should apply to slaves too. Venture seems not to have bought into that. And by the way, his name was Venture Smith because after he became free, he actually took his last owner's last name, which was a kind of practical thing to do because Oliver Smith was well known. So Venture Smith does this, buying his freedom, knowing or seeming to know that whatever freedom the white Americans get is not going to apply to him. All right, I'm gonna move on because I'm gonna come back to him and read a little bit. This one is the one of my six who everyone knows. This is George Washington at age 40, and this is based on a painting by Charles Wilson Peale. He, when I was working on this book, parallels between not just these the moments where their lives intersect, but parallels between the people would pop up. And one of the fascinating ones to me was the relationship of these people and their fathers. Venture Smith lost his father at the age of 10, and that episode changed his whole life. George Washington was the son of a Virginia planter. He had certain expectations. His father died when he was 11, and it changed the course of his life. His two older half-brothers had been sent to England to be educated, so he grows up with a sense of of honor and ambition and how you'll advance, and then it's thwarted. He's not able to go to England to be educated, so he takes it on himself. And there's this very poignant document that is still around that he, when he was 16 years old, he copied out of what was originally a French etiquette guide what he called rules of civility, 111 rules of civility, how to behave in polite society, how to behave with a person of quality. Things like when you're dining at a formal dinner and you're eating pitted fruit, don't spit the pit directly into your plate, but discreetly into your hand. And so he painstakingly copies all of these things out. You can see him. There's a wonderful book written in the 1980s called The Invention of George Washington. So you can see him sort of inventing himself. And he is all about honor and all about trying to get this honor that even though this path his path was changed. And for him, I think the most momentous event happened in when he was 22. He joined the Virginia militia, like George Sackville, joining the military to fulfill your ambition. And like George Sackville, he ends up in a disastrous situation. He is told to go to what is now Pittsburgh, to the forks of the Ohio River, and warn the French who were there to get away because this is English territory. Instead, he attacks this small group of French soldiers and massacres them. And this is the excuse the French were looking for to start the Seven Years' War. So the youthful disaster that George Washington engages in starts this war that the equal disaster that George Sackville engaged in on the other continent failed to end. So they're again, they're connected in these strange ways. I'm going to the rest of his story is kind of well known, but so I'm going to skip past that. This man's name is Kaietuake, in English, corn planter. He fascinates me because he was a Seneca warrior, and you know that stereotypical picture of the sort of noble warrior. He was that, but he was a complex man. He was philosophical. He was a political figure who understood the realities of politics. I think it stems from the fact that when he was a child, again, children and fathers, his mother was a noted woman, what's called a lineage matron in the Seneca, among the Seneca in upstate New York. But his father was a white man from Albany, New York, who was a kind of a ne'er-do-well, and he would go trading among the Indians. And so he was absent for most of a corn planter's upbringing. And when he's an adult, he talks of other boys in the village making fun of him because his skin was a different color. So he grows up and becomes a leader of the people. And George Sackville, going back to him, after the Battle of Saratoga, when the British lost an entire army, Sackville's enemies, calling him the Coward of Minden, were blaming him for this loss, and he decides then he's going to use what he called Roman severity on the Americans. So he's going to pull out all the stops, and one of the things is to bring the Iroquois in on the side of the British. So his agents meet with the Iroquois. Corn planter is at the meeting, and he argues that they should stay out of it. He's overruled, and he goes along with his people, with the will of the people, and he leads and fights against Americans, attacking American villages and forts. Then the British lose the war, which means the Iroquois lose the war. And then the Iroquois appoint him to be the one to negotiate with the Americans. So he's now in this position where he didn't even want them to be in this war, and he has to go to the Americans and negotiate. And they basically say, you backed the wrong side. We told you to stay out of it. Our people are already taking over your lands, and you know we signed a treaty with you before, and there's nothing we're going to do. We're not going to renege on it. So he goes back to his people, and some of them issue death threats against him. He's really caught in a bind. Eventually, he meets twice with George Washington when Washington is president. The last meeting, he says to him, and at this point, the Americans are basically forcing the Iroquois to sell lands to them. So at many stages in his life, you see him kind of as a metaphor for all of the native peoples caught in this bind and trying to get something out of it. So the last meeting, and this is on the last day of Washington's presidency, he says, in effect, look, we basically have to buy, or we basically have to sell our lands. In the past, we've sold land, and people have spent the money and it's gone and we've lost our land. I've heard that there are these things called banks, and I've heard that there's something called interest. Can you help me to understand this? If we sell the land, can we put it in the bank? Can it? So you see him trying to make something out of this, which is one reason I just find him to be such a poignant character. And by the way I tell these stories in the book, I'm kind of telling them individually now, but in the book they're all braided, starting with the birth of the first of them and ending with the death of the last. The clicker has failed to work. How do I move on? Can I move on here with the arrow? No. Oh, I see what happened. There. Okay, got it. This fellow's name is Abraham Yates. The class warfare, there was this class struggle at the nation's founding that is not often appreciated. He was the ninth child of a blacksmith. He was apprenticed to a shoemaker. He always had this sensibility of the commoner, and he always had this chip on his shoulder, this against the elites. So he fights, and he's from Albany, New York, and he is one of the earliest to declare that the American colonies should become independent. He trained himself in the law, and he worked his way up through local offices, political offices. He's one of the first to declare that the American colonies should declare independence. He's one of the first to quote John Locke on the situation. He works then in the war with other with the army. He writes letters back and forth with Washington as they're trying to maneuver to preserve the city of New York from the British. Then after the war, he turns on Washington and the other leaders because he says he sees right away what you're doing is replacing a foreign tyrannical elite with a homegrown tyrannical elite. All of you are these men who are, you know, oppressing the ordinary people. And what really galls him is when they decide that they're going to amend the Articles of Confederation, the system of government, which hadn't been working very well. He believes that what they're really going to do is throw it out and create a new government, a strong federal government, which will have this power over this oppressive power over the people. So when he hears about the Constitution, he says, "I told you so." What really galls him, and he's one of many anti-federalists, most of whom were farmers and tradesmen and people from the lower class. What really galls him is when he first sees the Constitution draft, the first three words, "We the people," because he knows it was just these elite men gathered in secret in a private room, and they presume to speak for all the people. This made him crazy. The office of the presidency he was scared by, because he said the way it is written in the Constitution, all a president has to do is to cajole the Senate into backing him, and then he can stack the Supreme Court with people who will follow him, and then we'll have a despot. So there are, you know, they say history repeats, or maybe more likely history echoes, and we're experiencing some of these echoes lately. He's one of these people who I think represents a kind of distrustful, rightfully distrustful populism that echoes all through American history, and you see it come up. And I think in our time, you see it both in people who backed Trump because they didn't like the federal government, and people who are opposed to Trump because they're afraid of the power of a president. Okay, the last of my figures is Margaret Moncrief Coghlan. This is another one that is not made from life. We don't know what she looked like. We know she was, it's based on descriptions of her, but also my sister put the mask on her partly to indicate that we don't really know what she looked like, but also because she, in London and Paris, became a great fixture at masked balls. She's an atypical person for me a woman for me to focus on of the period, because her life was very atypical. It would be anachronistic to talk about a woman's movement at that time, but this great wave of freedom was encompassing everyone of all walks of life. And one of the things it was focused on in the 1770s was a woman's right to marry for love, not to be forced into a marriage. And that is exactly the predicament that she got in as the war was unfolding, as in New York City, this was in New York City, her father was a British officer. He was a military officer whom the American officers thought was going to side with them, but he ended up siding with the British. He wanted her to marry another British officer whom she despised. So she goes off and tries to rebel against it and can't. He eventually forces her to marry him, and she hates the man. He's abusive. She eventually, now her story jumps across the ocean to Wales, and she can't stand it anymore, and she runs away from him. Literally in an inn, she runs out the door when his attention is elsewhere, runs into the mountains, walks for 60 miles to avoid him, never sees him again. And she then, the rest of her life, plays out far from what had been the American Revolution in London and Paris, and she decided, from our side, from our perspective, I think we would see her as someone who, a woman who is trying to live an independent life. That was basically impossible at the time. She concluded that there were two possible ways to do it. She could become an actress, or she could become a mistress. She tried both. She was more successful as a mistress. She became kind of a serial mistress to powerful men in London and in Paris. She ends up in Paris on the eve of the French Revolution. And her life then is this succession of highs and lows. She's suddenly at this masked ball, and all of these dignitaries are there, and the next moment she's in debtor's prison. So, as I say, her life carries out far from what we think of as the terrain of the American Revolution and the founding of the Republic. But really what I was interested in was following these lives and this broad, what unites them is this freedom, and where does it, how does it apply? And with her trying actually to take on independence for yourself as a woman at that time was simply not possible. Okay, what I would like to do now, if you don't mind, is just read a small section of the book to give you a little flavor of it. This is a section about Venture Smith, and this is when he has gotten his freedom and his family's freedom, and he decides, the war is going on, and he decides he's getting away from the coast, which is where the war is evident, and he finds a place, a town in the interior of Connecticut, a very rural place, called Haddam, and he settles there. With a few weak signals of incipient New England spring evident outside the window, Venture Smith stood in the cramped, low-ceilinged parlor of Jabez Chapman, Justice of Peace of the town of East Haddam, Connecticut. In his hand was one of the few tools he did not feel comfortable wielding, a quill pen. It was March 14th, 1777. Margaret Moncrief had recently become Margaret Coghlan. George Washington was camped at Morristown, New Jersey, pondering how to attack General Howe's army when it moved out of winter quarters. As far as Smith was concerned, America's war for independence was a distant and inchoate thing. More consequential were the two legal documents before him, which would, he hoped, bring the freedom and security for which he had longed ever since he had been forced from his homeland nearly four decades earlier. It was more than 2 years since he had moved here. His new home was a small rural community, or rather two communities. Haddam sat on the west side of the Connecticut River, East Haddam on the east side. The main thing that had attracted him to this area, besides its being away from the coast and the trouble of the war, was that not one, but two rich rivers dominated the landscape, the Connecticut and the Salmon River, which flowed into it. All rivers were highways. These two, in addition, were particularly fecund sources of life and income, wriggling with salmon and shad. Venture Smith had found that the two men he began working for on arrival, Timothy Chapman and Abel Bingham, were both people he could deal with. Chapman, who was born and raised in East Haddam, owned a sawmill, and he came to realize that Smith was an expert at felling trees and handling lumber. Bingham, meanwhile, who had only recently moved to Haddam, owned a large triangular-shaped tract of land right smack between the two rivers at a place called Haddam Neck. And this was what Smith found himself pondering in those first months. It was wild, thickly timbered and hilly, with a fine, fertile meadow. Shortly after his arrival, he struck a deal with Bingham to buy some of it. It was an odd bit of real estate to possess, a thin, rambling strip, too narrow, long, and steep to have much agricultural use. But it cost him only £25, and it was a foothold. A free Negro, he knew well, had no standing at all in Connecticut. He would have to forge a local identity, and the only path to that was through real estate. The population here was small, close-knit, conservative, and overwhelmingly white. Yet soon after his arrival, he decided he wanted to make the place his home. For the next 2 years, as he went about his work, Venture hiked his strip of land, as well as Bingham's adjacent larger parcel, studying it. It was darkened by ancient trees whose canopies closed out the sky. Yet as he tramped it, he realized he knew this land. He knew its seasons, bud and shoot, leaf and thistle, wing and hoof. He knew that when autumn came, mushrooms, meaty and loamy, would encrust the hillsides and cluster along dead logs. He knew the insects that would bite his flesh, the plant called goldenrod that would shoot up 4 feet high in late summer, topped with sweet-smelling yellow flowers that made a good tea. He knew the nuts that would plummet down through the trees. He knew how soft the land would be in summer after a day's sweaty, heaving work, and how hard to death it would be most other times. Most of all, he knew the trees, their trunks vaster around than three men could reach, piling themselves hundreds of feet into the air. These he could cut, saw, bite into with his blades. He could send them rocketing groundward, making the earth shudder as if it had feelings. He could strip and hack these trunks, use oxen to haul them downhill to the river, turning the steepness of the land to advantage. The trees were money. They were his future. For 2 years, then, he harvested trees from his narrow strip of property and sold his wood, floating it down the Salmon River to Basileel Brainerd's sawmill near the East Haddam Landing. He got to know everyone in the area, became financially tangled with them. There was no other way, for in a rural community, goods weren't bought and sold for ready money. All transactions were on account. People even settled their taxes in goods, using an official ledger to calculate their payment in grain, wood, or meat. When he needed staples, Venture went himself, or sent Meg, his wife, or his young son Solomon, to Ezra Brainerd's, to pick up leather, candles, beef, cider. Brainerd recorded each purchase, and at the end of the year, he agreed with Smith on a means of repayment. So many cords of wood, so many days of labor scything hay. In the same way, he made neighborly connections with Amos White, the cooper, and with James Green, a blacksmith and musket maker. Venture Smith was transactional by nature. He reckoned all his relationships, even with family members, in dollars or pounds. In doing business with local people, calculating the fruits of his labor against theirs, he stitched himself into the community. People began to talk about him, saying that he was as sturdy in his character as in his physical self. On this day, then, he was ready to make a complex deal, which involved a considerable understanding of the law and the frank goodwill of these two white neighbors. Abel Bingham didn't use the 70 acres that bordered Smith's property, and in fact was getting ready to leave the area, having signed on as a sergeant in a regiment gathered to join General Horatio Gates's army in its assault on Burgoyne's forces. He was willing to sell the land for 140 pounds. Venture Smith didn't quite have that much money, but Timothy Chapman stood ready to assist. Before Justice of the Peace Jabez Chapman, they executed a pair of agreements. In the first, Bingham agreed to sell to Venture a free Negro of Haddam, his plot of land for 140 pounds. In the second, Venture Smith agreed to sell half of this same parcel to Chapman for 55 pounds. Chapman wasn't actually buying the land. It was a mortgage, a backcountry loan, arranged without banks or intermediaries. Chapman's 55 pounds, which Smith would later repay, made it possible for Smith to buy the land that would give him his security. As they were filling out the papers, they noted a problem. The line for the date on the pre-printed form said, "In the blank year of the reign of our sovereign, Lord George III of Great Britain." They crossed out the line and wrote, "In the first year of independency of American states." Then Smith, who had never learned to read and write, put an X beside his name. He now owned 80 acres of Connecticut real estate. He was part of the community. Thank you. Thank you. I wanted to read a little bit to give you a sense of, because I'm in giving a talk, you talk about ideas, but really the book is about people and their, I wanted to get as close as I could to their experience and into their skin, so that I wanted to give you a taste of it. I'll end it there, and I'm happy to take questions or comments from anyone.
I have a question about Venture Smith. You said that he was married,
mm-hmm.
right? How did he get married? Was he married by a magistrate, or did he jump the broom? How did that happen?
Yeah, well, exactly how he got married, I don't know, because he doesn't record it. The reason I was able to focus on Venture Smith, and obviously slaves were lives tended not to be very well documented, but late in life he dictated his life story, and he doesn't mention exactly how, but his wife, Meg, was also a slave of the first his first owner, and he allowed them to marry, but he doesn't tell us the details.
How did white people get married? Did they have a magistrate or
preacher? Magistrates in churches. And an interesting thing about that with Venture Smith is he seems never to have become a Christian. There's a man named Paul Lovejoy who is an Africa scholar who helped me to understand Venture's life in Africa, and he thinks that Venture was probably Muslim in Africa, and mixed with kind of animist beliefs, and so we have no indications of him and religion while he's a slave, but once he moves, as I just read about, to Haddam and builds his house and buys land. Archaeologists have found indications in the soil, crystals buried and things like that, which indicate that he was now resurrecting things from his childhood.
Did you mention regarding Venture Smith, they wouldn't allow real estate transactions with black men or? For slaves in Connecticut, and how did they get around that in that transaction?
Yeah, being a freed slave was a very precarious thing. In some ways, it was harder than being a slave, because being a slave, at least, that was an institution that everybody understood. Communities all over the country passed laws forbidding freed slaves from settling, because they just thought there were going to be problems. For one thing, if you were a freed slave and you became destitute, then the town had to deal with you. So then they passed laws saying, if you free a slave and he becomes destitute, you, the last owner, are going to be responsible for paying for his keep. So there were all kinds of problems. And real estate, it was very unusual for a slave to be allowed, or a freed black, to be allowed to buy real estate. And so he did it in this way that, that allowed him to, enabled him to do so, but that also at the same time bonded him to the community, which was, especially in rural areas, was something that was very important. Most freed slaves gravitated to cities where they could form support groups, basically, but in a rural place like that, you couldn't. What he did in addition, once he created this, he had more than 100 acres of land, and he then started to draw other freed blacks to him, and they came and worked on his property. So at one point in the book, I compare his land with George Washington's Mount Vernon, which would have been both well-ordered estates worked by blacks, but the difference being that Venture Smith's, they were freed.
Thank you so much for your reading. You're an exquisite exquisite writer. The narratives you craft are just really gripping and compelling. So could you talk more about narrative history and what you think the value of that is and why you pursue it?
Yeah, he's asked, you heard him, about narrative history. As I said, to me, narrative is people in conflict in their time. And a lot of academic history follows a different kind of, it can be quantitative, for example, in the way it identifies material to focus on. There are a lot of different, it can be thematic. And all of that is relevant, and I use all of that and rely on those people's work as well as on primary source material. But I think that humans have always gotten meaning from stories, and it's a very important way to transmit information and knowledge, and the stories that we do, which is why I guess I decided to write a book about the American founding, because this is our creation myth, and this is a different way. I wanted to do it in a way that, by focusing on people from different backgrounds, that reflected not just, better reflected who they were then, but reflects who we are today as well. And who they were then was, it was very diverse. You know, people spoke Dutch and German and Swedish, and there were Shawnee and Iroquois and rich and poor, and so, you know, to give a sense of all of that, I think that narrative is an important device. And but I also, the tricky thing is, as I said before, you want to ground everything, you know, and so you footnote like mad. And I decided with this book, a slight departure from my earlier ones, not to sort of mix historiography with history. In other words, if what someone else might do, what I might have done, is if I'm talking about some episode in George Washington's life, kind of pause and say, this is what his 19th century biographers thought, but we have since learned, blah, blah, blah. So I don't want to do any of that in the text. I start the book, we're in the English countryside, and there's this grand house in the distance, and we're heading there, and I just want to stay in the story. And then any of that sort of writing or information about the history that I think is important, I put in a footnote.
I'm interested that given your writing about the Dutch and Amsterdam and in the past, that you didn't pick a character with some Dutch influence, and I'm interested on whether
the book came out last week, and I've given about four talks, and all four times I noted the Dutch connections, but this time for some reason I didn't. Two of these people actually have Dutch ancestry. One of them is Abraham Yates, whose mother was Dutch, and he was a shoemaker. Dutch was his mother tongue, and his account book in the New York State Library still exists, and you see him making shoes for people and writing out "een paar schoenen voor je kind," you know, one pair of shoes for your child. And the other one, believe it or not, is Corn Planter. His father, who I referred to, I think I said he was a white man, he was actually Dutch, from upstate New York, because the Dutch colony was prevalent, and this is only 100 years after the takeover of the Dutch colony by the English, and upstate New York was still quite Dutch. So there, two out of the six have Dutch pieces. All right, everyone, thank you very much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.